TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I sang using my voice as an instrument. The early stuff, Murmur particularly, it's like Sigur Rós or This Mortal Coil, Elizabeth Frazier, people that are creating languages or just singing nonsense without narrative. The narrative is within the emotion and the feeling of the voice.
From the TED Audio Collective, this is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. For 17 years, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative people about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about and working on. On this episode, Michael Stipe talks about his life in music and photography.
I've had this extraordinary life surrounded by and meeting incredible, incredible people.
When Michael Stipe was the lead singer and lyricist for the band R.E.M., it was clear he had talents and interests beyond music. He was deeply involved in crafting the album covers and other aspects of the band's visual identity. In 1998, he published his first photo book, and in recent years, he's published several more books of photography. His latest is an untitled book of portraits and still lives, the making of which was complicated, in interesting ways, by COVID. He joins me now to talk about his practice of photography and about his career as a musician and an artist. Michael Stipe, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you, Debbie. How's it going? It's so nice to see you.
So nice to see you too. Michael, I understand that the best kiss of your life was with Allen Ginsberg.
Well, that was a questionnaire for the Guardian or the Independent.
It was for a UK paper for sure.
One of the UK papers, and you know they think that Americans have no sense of humor or sense of irony, so I work extra hard to create ridiculous responses to their questions.
Oh, so it wasn't really true?
Well, it was a very memorable kiss, Allen's kiss. Yes, we were working together. We worked several years with Tibet House out of New York City. There was a yearly benefit, an annual benefit to support Tibet House. And I got involved through Patti Smith and through Philip Glass. And Allen was always there up until his death. Allen was standing side of stage when I was introduced as the magnificently talented and irresistible Michael Stipe. And I got up and I did my thing, a couple songs, walked off stage into the arms of Allen Ginsberg, who grabbed me by the shoulders, planted a kiss squarely on my mouth and said, "Irresistible." I mean, the guy was this, you know, massive hero of mine from the age of 17, and here he is kissing me on the mouth and calling me irresistible. It was quite memorable and funny.
That actually sounds really yummy. if you want me to be honest, I think that sounds really yummy. Michael, you were born in Georgia, and that is also where your grandparents are from, but your family traveled a great deal while you were growing up. Your dad was in the Army. Where were some of the other places that you lived?
It seems like I have this very particular memory that's super specific to the time that we spent in Germany outside of Frankfurt. in a place called Hanau. Hanau is where during World War II, they told everyone in Frankfurt to turn off their lights and they told everyone in Hanau to turn on their lights. So Hanau was bombed to shit and then it became an army base after the war. That's where my father was stationed in 1966 and 67, I believe. I spent the summer of love there, I remember. But I have these very distinct, almost hour-by-hour memories of that time. I'm speaking to you actually from Athens, Georgia, which is where my family live and where my former band was based. I kept a home here that I bought when I was 25 years old. So I come back for holidays and to visit family, but I wound up spending actually a huge part of the pandemic here. Why am I talking about that? You mentioned my grandparents. Well, interestingly, they're not all from Georgia. My grandmother was born on a reservation in North Carolina called Black Mountain, and she was actually born on Black Mountain. My grandfather is from South Carolina. My maternal grandmother is from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And my pappy, who is my maternal grandfather, was actually born in Alabama, I think. But they all settled for one reason or another into Georgia. And that's where, when my parents met each other, that's where they were, here in Georgia.
You mentioned some of your memories. I read about a unique memory that you have of your childhood, one when you were 4 years old, and upon looking at a light bulb, you decided you wanted to become the filament. The only way you thought you could do that was to bite into the light bulb, which you did. And your father and uncle found you trying to eat the bulb and ultimately tried to pull the pieces out of your mouth and then try to put the light bulb back together with glue to make sure you hadn't swallowed it. I thought that was a really unique memory and sort of the beginnings of a baby artist right there.
Wow, that's beautiful. Thank you. I can actually move back a couple of years. I think I was four when that happened. I distinctly remember them being horrified at my attempt to become the filament. And what's interesting to me as an adult, what's interesting is that I really meant it. I wanted to be the thing that lights up. And I didn't understand that, of course, I'm made of very different materials than the filament of a flashlight light bulb. And that wasn't going to happen, at least on this particular plane of existence. But I did try. A few years before that, and again, my mother and I were talking about this the other day, because she said, honey, you were so sick. I contracted pneumonia and strep throat, and then it turned to scarlet fever. And that was the second memory that I had, my first memory being my sister's birth when I was 2 years old. And then 2 months later, right before my third birthday, I had this terrible fever. You know, William Burroughs told Patti Smith that they were both members of the Scarlet Fever Club. It boils your brain. It makes your synapses connect in a different way, according to William. And, you know, maybe we're exaggerating a bit. I hope so. But if someone can exaggerate my second memory in life, I would hope that it would be William Burroughs. I had scarlet fever, and so maybe the idea that I could, at 4 years old, turn myself into the filament was not so outrageous.
Was it at that moment that you felt it was important that you actually light up a room?
I was called Mike Stipe, the Shining Light, when my name was Mike. That was my nickname in kindergarten and in first grade. Now, that was also in Germany. So again, I remember virtually every day of it. And I was learning. I was a slow learner in many regards. So I was learning how to read and write then. I was left-handed. My mother made the decision that you are too. My mother made the decision that that they would not try to change me to suit the idea that all people should be right-handed. And so she allowed me to be left-handed. But I wasn't learning at the same rate as other kids. I was in third grade before I learned how to read a clock. And it was this abstract concept, the round thing with the arms. I couldn't connect that to the passage of time.
Yeah, it wasn't until years later that there were digital clocks that I'm always so sad when people rely on digital clocks, because I think there is something kind of wonderful about the idea of reading time as if that's something that could be ever static.
One of my first sculpture pieces, going back to, I guess it was 2006 or 2007, is an exact replica in cardboard of my first digital alarm clock, which also played music. So it was this combination of kind of the future along with being able to listen to the radio, two things that for me are profoundly important. My dreamscape pretty much exists in this post-apocalyptic future that's got a lot of water. No Kevin Costner, but a lot of water. But it's not terrifying. Everything's held together by scotch tape and staples, but it's not a terrifying place. It's actually quite welcoming. How did I get into that now, Debbie? I have to say, I'm drinking my first cup of tea in a month. I haven't had caffeine in over a month. So I'm going very slow with the caffeine here. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But you might have to remind me why we're going in different directions.
Not a problem. I don't mind doing that at all. Do you keep track of your dreams? Do you write them down when you wake up and analyze them?
I'd like to say yes, but I don't. No, I don't. The ones that I need to remember, I remember. And then some of them, like last night's dream, I'd really rather just let go of. The only thing I write on paper is my schedule and pop lyrics, everything else. And pop lyrics even kind of wind up more on the computer these days than on paper. I don't like my handwriting. I find it distracting and imperfect. And I can write something brilliant, but if it's a bad handwriting day, I'll just throw it away or I'll disregard the idea. Equally, and I learned this with lyric writing, pop lyric writing, I can write something really bad. And if it's a good handwriting day, I'll think that it's the best thing I've ever written. And it isn't, you know.
How do you come to whether or not you're having a good or bad handwriting day? What are the criteria to create a good handwriting day?
I look at it and it's either appealing to me or it's mortifying. And it's more often than not mortifying.
So you have no control over the output?
No. And I don't think that has to do with being left-handed. I don't know if you have a similar problem, but I do smear things a lot. So there's a lot of smearing that happens. I used to write kind of sideways, upside down, but that was really painful. I think a lot of left-handed people have that same experience. I also walk into doors a lot. Do you?
Yes. Yeah. We, you know, it's very funny. Terry Teachout, the theater critic for the Wall Street Journal and also a playwright and dramaturg, once told me that he falls a lot. He's also left-handed. And he said that he's been told that left-handed people see the world backwards. And that's why we often have spatial issues. I have a lot of spatial issues. So yeah, I trip and fall and bang into things all the time.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm really bad that way.
Are you able to write mirror backwards? A lot of left-handed people can do that without even realizing they can do it.
Until I was in the seventh grade, and then I had a teacher who pulled me aside, and she had gotten tired of, she would grade my papers by holding them up to a light bulb and grade the back of them. I wrote exact mirror image until,
yeah, me too.
What is seventh grade? I was 12 years old, yeah. But she said, and this is probably almost a direct quote, she said, "Your brain is like two fish that are going to flip-flop if you continue doing this." And I could visualize that, and it terrified me, so I stopped doing it.
Oh, well, I bet you could still do it. I don't think it's something you can unlearn. I actually think the opposite. I think that there's something kind of wonderful about flipping back and forth left brain, right brain, and it's never flip-flopped in a way that felt like a fish.
It's really good in meetings because I can read when people have papers on their desk. I can read everything. Upside down and is it upside down and backwards? It looks backwards, but yeah, I'm able to read.
Just mirror backwards, yeah. Like Da Vinci.
Exactly. Well, I did think, and this is really an exclusive, Debbie, I wouldn't say this to many people, but for a moment, as a young, I'm going to place myself at 11. I thought that I was the reincarnation of Leonardo da Vinci.
And I think love that.
Because he had really bad hair and he wrote mirror backwards. And I was like, okay, I've got bad hair and I write mirror backwards. So
it works for me. You first started reading about the club, CBGBs, when you were 13 in the magazine, I believe it's called Rock Scene. And that is also when you made your first recording. And I understand your sister had one of those old school audio tape recorders. And one day when everyone had left, you locked yourself in the den in the basement, turned the machine on record, and screamed for 10 minutes.
All this is true, but it was a Cream magazine.
Ah.
I can picture her bedroom and sitting on the corner of her bed with this. It was like a secretary's early cassette recorder. And what I would not give to have that tape today. I would really.
That was my next question.
I'd put a disco backbeat on it, and it would be in my mind anyway. The greatest hit single of all time. Yeah, that was my first recording. But I was 15 in detention. And this was in a different place. We were now in Collinsville, Illinois, outside of East St. Louis. I was in detention in high school, and I found under my desk a Cream magazine with an article written by Lisa Robinson about the CBGB scene and how, compared to the popular music of the time, it was like watching an old movie on a black and white TV with static and noise versus the kind of Technicolor cinematic music that was popular on the radio at the time. And she was drawing this obvious parallel to the more energetic and chaotic scene that was happening around groups like the Ramones, Blondie, Television, Patti Smith Group, et cetera, at CBGB. And comparing it to what was on the radio, which at the time was really uninteresting and boring.
You were originally a fan of the Archies, I believe.
I love the Archies. I have an older sister, but she wasn't into music. My parents were not really into music that much. And so what I had was pop radio in Texas, mostly. The formulative radio listening years for me were in Texas up until the age of 13. That's when we moved to outside of East St. Louis, and I was teased mercilessly for my accent, which had been at the time a Georgia, South Georgia accent run through. And now keep in mind, grandmother from North Carolina, grandfather from South Carolina, grandmother from Mississippi, grandfather from Alabama. They all grew up in Washington, D.C., or Washington, as my grandmother would call it, and then South Georgia. Run that through Texas and run it through Germany. Plopped out at the age of 13 in a little kind of white flight, drug-addled town outside of East St. Louis, and I was teased mercilessly for my accent. They called me because I had really long eyelashes, and I was a little faggy, but I was more just really a nerd. They called me the Maybelline Cowboy, and it was extremely painful. I wasn't really deeply bullied until those years, but that's when the bullying really began. I changed my accent very quickly. I took some play school scissors and I chopped my eyelashes off. I tried to fit in. It didn't work. So I got a very early lesson in trying to fit in, recognizing that that's not working, and deciding to kind of be yourself. And that led us on what I think is a pretty spectacular path.
Talk about how you accidentally got a subscription to the Village Voice.
Well, younger listeners would not remember this, but for a dime, you could get subscriptions to 12 magazines for a year if you just subscribed to some Random House kind of thing. I don't know what it was. It was in the back of all magazines and newspapers. I mean, comic books, rather. And my sister, she got like Red Book for my mom. I don't know, Life magazine, and all the magazines of the like early 70s, late 60s. And the Village Voice seemed interesting to her. So we got a year subscription to the Village Voice. That introduced me to this whole other universe, of course, of New York and New York culture. And that played a really heavy and important role in my embracing punk rock at the age of 15 and recognizing that that was my tribe and that's where I was comfortable. And of course, there was no one around me who acknowledged or even knew about what was happening with punk rock and with the punk rock scene. So I was really, really on my own. I mean, I made mimeographs at school that said Tom Verlaine was the founder of the band Television. Tom Verlaine is God. And I went to school early one day and I put up these posters, these mimeograph posters all over school. I almost shut the school down because the English teacher said, clearly someone is referring to the French poet Paul Verlaine. So they got that wrong. But how dare they blaspheme our Lord and Savior by referring to a French poet as God? And so there was this whole like investigation to find out who blasphemed the school. It was me, and it was Tom Verlaine from the band Television, but nobody had any idea. Anyway, that was me at the age of 15. I was a little bit of a scamp, I guess.
Did anybody ever find out it was you?
They never did. And there are other secrets from that era that probably are not repeatable on your podcast.
You know, I'm thinking back to my first introduction to the Village Voice, which kind of happened around the time it was around 1982 when I first graduated college. I was already familiar with your work in REM, but I came to Manhattan after going to school in Albany, New York, and my dad had lived in the Village while I was growing up, but I didn't spend a lot of time there. Found this newspaper and thought it was sort of like a primer to the world. And at the time, I was really, really afraid of coming out. I was afraid of the judgment. You know, I was when I was doing a lot of my research on your background and your history, I was reading about how you grappled with your thoughts about coming out back in the early 80s. And I read it out loud to Roxanne because I thought, you know, she's 14 years younger than me, and that's a big difference in the world of coming out. And I'm like, see, this is what Michael was feeling at that time. That's exactly what I felt like. Suddenly you're going to be judged. It might affect everybody around you. You were really scared about what it would mean to your bandmates and how the world would treat the band. And it was such a different time. I mean, we're so lucky now that the world has changed to the degree it has, although it certainly has so much more to go. But reading what you were going through really helped her understand why it took me so long to come out. So thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, my bandmates and everyone around me knew my sexuality all along. They you know, we lived together. They couldn't ignore or disregard who was coming up into my room and leaving the next morning. Yeah, it was. I mean, I turned 20 years old in 1980, and you know what I think that LGBTQIA plus, if I can use today's terms and apply that to the late 70s, that liberation, that moment should have happened in the late 70s, following civil rights and following the women's liberation movement. That was a movement that was in our country certainly not just diminished but squashed completely by the advent of AIDS and of course the Reagan administration, and Reagan and Bush Senior kind of taking over for the whole of the 1980s and into the early 90s. It took a revolution and shifted it by a good 20 years, which is, I think, why when it finally did happen, it happened so quickly that a lot of people's heads are still spinning, trying to figure out where they are or who they are within it, not only within the straight community, but also within, as we call it, the LMNOPs, all of us. Trying to figure out who they are and where they fit in. This is something I really love about the 21st century. From the moment I did start speaking about my sexuality publicly, and for me it was more a matter of privacy than anything else, but I just felt like I'd given so much of myself as a public figure and as a pop star to the public. I wanted to keep something to myself, and of course I chose the wrong thing to keep. I now recognize how powerful it is to have people like ourselves in the public eye, and that's profoundly important to people who are struggling with their own situations. But anyway.
But I also think, you know, you had already been bullied. And I think once you're bullied, once you feel damaged by who you are, it's very hard to keep putting it out there because of the pain that you've already experienced and the pain you're afraid you're going to still feel.
Well, the people I surrounded myself with as a 20-year-old were people that understood who I was, and they had no problem with that. And in fact, I think it was encouraged, you know, that I be exactly who I am, because the result of that is that we were not your typical pop band at all. We were never really a rock band, although we used some of those sounds. But my being a part of it just radically shifted the focus of the band completely. And I think those guys acknowledged and recognized, when I say those guys, Peter, Mike, and Bill, of course, my former bandmates, but then also the people around us. It was clear that we were very, very different. And part of that, I think, really had to do with my sexuality and my identity and how that placed me in a very different sphere than most of what normal pop culture would offer you.
One of the things that I do now, in addition to the podcast, is teach. And I teach undergrads, seniors at the School of Visual Arts. And one of the things that I talk to them about is their hopes and dreams and what they want to be and what they want to do in their lives. And I find really tragically that they're already at 18, 19, 20, 21, beginning to think about what they can't do as opposed to what they can. You know, they start limiting the possibilities of their life before they even try to make anything possible. And I was really, really struck by something that I read that you said. You said that your greatest achievement has been deciding what you wanted to do at 15 and against all odds doing it. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what gave you the sense back then that it could be done.
Delighted. And interesting that you talk about kids today using a process of negation to try to figure out who they are and how kind of sad and upsetting that is. My band, or my former band, REM, we used a process of negation quite regularly to figure out what we did not want to be, not only as public figures, but as songwriters, the way that we dressed ourselves, the way we presented ourselves, the way we talked to the press. We knew all the embarrassing and fucked up tropes. So we used a process of negation to figure out how to not be those horrible idiot cliches. And I think we did a pretty good job of it over the course of 32 years. But going back to when I was 15, yeah, I mean, it was unbelievably naive of me to think that when I read these articles about the punk rock scene as a 15-year-old, I read them and what these people were saying over and over again were that we're not special, we're not particularly talented, we're normal people. Anybody can do this. Anybody can pick up a guitar. Anybody can grab a microphone and start to sing. I took it quite literal when they said anyone can do this. I was like, okay, that's me. That's what I'm going to do. It was an insane teenage dream that became an even more insane adult reality. Being the singer of a band, I became the singer because I didn't know how to play an instrument. I didn't know I had a voice when I was 18 years old or 15 years old or 19 when I started REM. I certainly didn't know I had this voice. I like my voice a lot, and I think I've become a very good singer with a very distinct voice, but I didn't know that at that age. I just knew that that's what I wanted to do. But then learning that you have to not only have the audacity to present yourself publicly, but also that you have to have something behind that. There's got to be at least a modicum of talent. I didn't know you had to write songs. So I didn't know what a bass guitar was until we started our second album. I couldn't identify the bass guitar sounds from the guitar sounds. I didn't know that the one with four strings made all the low notes and the one with six strings made all the high notes. I mean, that's how naive I was about music. And you can hear it in the early stuff. I mean, it's quite, and they're beautiful. I'm not disregarding those recordings at all. They are, for some people, quite magical. But I hear and I acknowledge a band and within myself, an artist learning how to not crawl publicly, learning how to be a toddler publicly, learning how to poop his diapers a few times. And then if we can carry this a little further, I finally take the training wheels off the bike and I'm actually a songwriter and a lyricist. And now I find I wrote a song last night, Debbie. I'm so excited. I took this crazy moment at a house party in London, maybe 15 years ago, with a bunch of friends dancing. And this thing that came out of my mouth to a great friend of mine on the dance floor. And I always remember this phrase. Well, it presented itself at 2 o'clock this morning with a song written on a Moog synthesizer in 2018, pre-pandemic, that has been sitting around in the studio. And last night, they came together and created this, what I'm going to go in tonight and see if there's anything to it. But I woke up really excited that this insane phrase from 15 years ago, a London house party, has found its way into a song written on a Moog in 2018. And in 2021, boom, here it is. So we'll see. Hopefully it'll wind up on what is, I'm certain to be a solo record that's going to be coming out probably within the next year. Hopefully, yeah.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
Hey, y'all, it's Elise. I have another podcast to tell you about. It's called In the Making. It's an original podcast brought to you by Adobe Express. It's the all-in-one content creation app included in your Creative Cloud membership. In the Making takes an honest look at the challenges and rewards of being part of the creator economy. The series kicks off with Puno, who is a creative director and educator. On the show, host Teresa Au explores how you can use the principles of design to create a career you love. Puno did it. Puno is a web designer and content creator and the founder of an online education platform called I Love Creatives. And on the show, Puno shares her journey from working on the Call of Duty video game to building both a design studio and a trade school for digital design. Puno has practical advice for taking a thoughtful and iterative approach to career building. Most importantly, this show is actionable. It's about how you can take your own next step in the creative world and into the creator economy. It'll help you discover creative, intriguing people who are making a living, and it'll probably inspire you no matter what you do. I know it certainly did for me. Search for In the Making in your podcast player. My thanks to In the Making and Adobe Express for their support.
You stated that it took you the better part of your 20s to recognize that insecurities are actually a superpower and something that you could utilize to allow your better work to come forward. And you also realized that you didn't have to be snippy and cynical. And you've said that, quote, cold ass bitch was a coat I put on to protect myself. And I realized I can take that coat off now, which I love. How did you come to that realization? How did you get to that point where you could throw off that coat?
Yeah. Wow. I can't believe that quote came out of my mouth, but it did. Anyone who knows the band from earlier days, I would come on stage wearing 4 or 5 layers of clothing and usually a hat and maybe some glasses. And as I got heated up during the performance, I would take them off. And by the end of the evening, by the end of the performance, I was down to a t-shirt or, you know, down to my jeans, no shirt at all. I always felt the need to protect myself and to layer myself from the world at large. I was born a very shy person. I'm not anymore because I had to learn how to not be. But the part of that, Debbie, that I find interesting is that I was really moving on instinct. And instinct was telling me that the things that are embedded into me and a part of who I am, the very part of my DNA that allows that insecurity, allows that vulnerability, part of it being queer, part of it being, you know, bullied, if you will, as a child, part of it being from a family that had this nomadic, peripatetic, crazy pick up and move every couple of years lifestyle, and having to really be fiercely independent or independent within a very tight family unit of 2 sisters and a mother and father. All of this created, I guess, an instinct that allowed me to, without acknowledging it and without having the language to describe it to myself, allowed me to use that insecurity and that vulnerability to create the persona that became who I am. And that gets into a whole other philosophical or deeply psychological, I guess, arena that we don't need to go into. We become who we want to become, and then we create who we want to become, and then we become them. But I didn't have the language to recognize that until much, much later. When I did, I had established myself enough that it didn't knock me backwards or throw me off my game. It simply allowed me to look at the earlier work and not disregard it so easily, and to acknowledge, wow, I did do stuff that was incredibly ballsy and incredibly courageous. I just didn't see it as such. And I still don't think of myself. I still have, what is it, imposter syndrome. Mm. You know, I always think that the next song or the next photo book is going to be the one where everyone realizes that I'm a big fake. And that in its own regard can be a great power, a superpower. I'm a little bit quoting Greta Thunberg, who referred to when she became a public figure through her activism and then was being mocked by the world's media. How embarrassing are we as Americans? But being mocked for her voice, acknowledged publicly that her being on the spectrum, being autistic, was what she regarded as a superpower. And I was like, whoa, hang on a second. Here's a teenage girl telling me that this thing that we've thought of my whole life as something that's a disability, she regards as a superpower. I have those superpowers within my vulnerability and my insecurities, and I've actually employed those throughout my entire adult life and with the work that I've presented as a public figure, as a pop star, as a singer-songwriter, as an artist, as a photographer, et cetera. And wow, what a thank you, Greta Thunberg, for allowing me to see myself a little more clearly. I'm sometimes embarrassed that it feels like I start every sentence with the word I feel a little navel-gazy, but part of being a pop star allows you to not only acknowledge that the ego that it takes to get up on a stage and think that what you have to say or sing or present is valuable to someone beyond yourself also comes hand in hand with the humility of stepping back and recognizing that if you start to believe your own myth, you're screwed and the work that you do is vastly unimportant. You are really, really human. And that humanity, I think I'm just, this sounds insane to me coming out of my mouth, but that humanity, that humility combined with that ego is what I think that friction can create beautiful work, whether it's in a writer, in people that performance artists and dancers, or in something as rigid as opera or ballet, or in something as freeform as my idea theoretically of what punk rock means. You
know? Yeah, it's interesting. In spending time researching a lot of the things that you were a part of and talked about and wrote about through the 80s till now, I was very aware of your awareness of the sort of tides as they go back and forth between acceptance and reverence and people then getting upset about the very things that they used to be excited about and how you have to temper how you consider what you mean to them by what you mean sort of internally and hold on to that in some way.
Wow. Can you expand
that? That makes sense.
No. Can you expand on that a little bit more? I'm really intrigued.
Well, I remember you were talking about one of the albums that you released not being as popular as some of the bigger, more sort of stadium albums. And, you know, I have stacks and stacks of your work. And
thank you.
They have the very, very early work appealed to a certain type of people. The later more stadium work, I'm talking about, you know, Losing My Religion and sort of the world of that super duper heavy popular music that people, you know, all the out of time. And then when you have something that might be smaller or less appreciated by the masses, you know, it's still work that has meaning. And if you start to, and I, you know, talk to Roxanne about this all the time, if you start to measure your value and worth by the amount of books that are sold or the amount of albums that are sold or the amount of downloads or the amount of streams, you put your whole life in control of something that isn't you.
You're also competing, and I can't possibly compete with my past, and I have no desire to, nor with whoever the pop stars of 2021 or 2022. I have no desire to even try to compete with that. I read an article, I think it was in The Guardian, about Damon Albarn from the band Blur. Mm-hmm. He's someone who I deeply admire. And the point that they were making is the writer was saying, here's someone who had huge success and then did something quite unusual, which is didn't try to continue having this success upon success upon success on a mass scale, but spent the next 20 years doing exactly what he wanted to do, experimenting with different types of music and musicians and different ways of presenting music and performance together through stage and theater and what have you. He's someone who I deeply admire, one, but it also, I was like, oh, wow, I wish I had done that the way he did that. I'm now, so it's a day later, I'm thinking about what I have done, and I've done okay. You know, I think I've presented some pretty interesting things in the past decade, certainly since the band disbanded. It's not at all, I'm looking at the span of my life, and I'm looking at time remaining, and I want to do a whole lot more. I actually thought about this yesterday as well. At my age, I'm 61 now, and I look great, but at 61, most people are thinking about retiring, and as an artist, I can't retire. Even the thought of that is ridiculous. I look at my heroes, whether it's Leonard Cohen, certainly Patti Smith, Edmund White, people that continue working until the end of their lives, not because they want to, not because they're having to pay the bills, not because they have some fragile ego that has to be supported by this desire to be appreciated from outside. No, it's because you have to do it. It's really not a choice.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I just turned 60 and feel, while I do feel time in a way that I really haven't, before. I mean, it's been escalating since I turned 50. So, but I also am more urgent in thinking, you know, if not now, when? And it reminds me of when I interviewed David Lee Roth 2 years ago, when we were talking about 1984, and I asked him how it felt to be, you know, at that moment in time, like the most popular dude on the planet, you know, the biggest album, the biggest tour, the biggest music video, everything that there was.
And biggest hair.
His surprise. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I've talked about this at length. I asked him what it felt like, and he paused and he was extremely thoughtful. And he said, you have to be really careful when you get to the top of the tallest mountain, because it's always cold. You're usually alone and there's only one direction. And I've suddenly felt really comforted by the idea that you can sort of slowly walk up the mountain and maybe, if you're lucky, not peak until the day before you die.
Wow. I wouldn't have expected that from David Lee Roth. That's incredible.
I know. I love that he said that. It really was extraordinary. All that being said, I do want to talk to you about a couple of your early pieces, only because they mean so much to me and sort of the formation of who I am. So I'm going to be really selfish and just want to ask you about a couple of songs, because had I thought at the time that, you know, 30 years later, I'd be talking to you about these songs, I would have, you know, just said, Debbie, you never have to worry about anything again because everything's going to just be fine. I want to talk to you about Harbor Coat. Harbor Coat is one of my all-time favorite songs. Uh-huh. Like if somebody said, Debbie, write down top 10 songs of your life, it would be Harbor Coat. And not only is it one of my favorite songs of all time, but there's a line in it that I use sort of to describe a moment in time. And at first, you know, when the album first came out, I'm talking about the album Murmur.
Reckoning.
Reckoning. I'm going to say that again.
1984.
Yeah.
Right.
Reckoning came out.
Okay.
Yep. I have it both the album and the CD. That's how much I love this. And I also have all the sort of digital versions of it, because it's just easier to listen to music that way. But I would never, ever give these up. So these are all the first pressings. And you didn't include the lyrics at the time. You had to really, really listen. And people would argue, what does this mean? What does that mean? What is he saying here? What is he saying there? And I want to talk to you about that in a second. But I want to ask you about this line. I spent my whole life waiting to ask you this. There's a splinter in your eye, and it reads, react.
If you're asking me where that came from, I have no idea. I think it's that instinct that we were talking about. I was a fan of William Burroughs and Brian Geisen, and I was very familiar with the cut-up technique that they had employed through their own work. And mostly through the bands that were coming up with REM through the Athens, Georgia scene, specifically Pylon and the B-52s, the idea of taking these random thoughts and ideas and throwing them together in a kind of Brian Geisen, William Burroughs mashup was kind of common. And so what does that mean? I mean, I was 24. I was already kind of a pop star. The band had already gotten named the record of the year over Michael Jackson's Thriller with our first album, which sold 40,000 copies at the time.
Yeah.
Was that the Village Voice or?
New York Times rated it the number one album of the year.
Over Michael Jackson's Thriller. And we were living at the time when we were in New York, which was a lot of the time, on 44th Street at the Iroquois Hotel. It's where James Dean lived when he was studying acting in New York. We were in his room, we were told. And Sammo used to go into he would tag the elevator. It was the slowest elevator in New York City.
Oh my God.
But Sammo was, of course, Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I mean, it was just this moment, you know, there was all this stuff was happening around us. But I would pick phrases out of the air and just throw them into the songs and not think twice about it. Where that came from, I have no idea, Debbie, but it sure does sound good. And it means something to me, most certainly. That's the line in the song, actually. You're at the peak of the mountain right now. You picked the very best line in that song to focus on. Maybe we'll get tattoos together at some point, but I think having a tattoo of my own lyric on my body would be a little creepy. So I'd get a tramp stamp across the back so I'd never have to do it.
Well, now I use it. I use it as a way to explain what it means to cut off your nose to spite your face,
exactly.
Which is so much more poetic.
Exactly.
So my last question about that particular song, and then I'll leave you alone about it. Just you know, as I said, it's my life playlist. What is a harbor coat?
Well, to me, that line for me is about like everything seems to be going right, but there's something niggling. There's something that's irritating. There's something that's not quite on. And what is that? What you need to investigate, you need to step back, you need to look again and figure out what doesn't feel exactly right. And that's when you have to change things slightly, maybe just shift them incrementally. But a harbor coat, no idea. I mean, again, I was walking on stage in probably 4 or 5 layers of clothing. And after the first song, the coat would come off, usually an overcoat, actually. The hat would come off. And then a shirt, and then a jacket, and then a shirt, and then another shirt, and then I'd be down to a t-shirt at the time. Later, when I realized that sex sells, I would strip down to my bare body and sometimes shave my chest because it looked better from a distance, you know, depending on how big the venues were. But I was a skinny little thing back then. And I was wearing the coat. I was literally embodying my own lyric. I was protecting myself.
And the other thing about the early albums, you know, they are pop albums, and one could also call them rock albums, but you have a lot of love songs. Perfect Circle, Talk About the Passion. There's so many love songs that are almost like Trojan horses on these pop albums.
In a way, because I intentionally did not write love songs. I don't think I used the word love in a song until our 7th or 8th album, maybe. I mean, it was way, 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 way.
Oh, but Perfect Circle is one of the great love songs of all time, really.
Thank you. It's such a sad song to me.
I know, but that's what I love about it. Why were you so opposed to having the lyrics on the sleeves?
I sang using my voice as an instrument. And again, that's something I picked up from Vanessa Briscoe from Pylon, I think talked about her voice as an instrument. And I again, very quite literally, and naively, I said, oh, okay, my voice is an instrument too. So that's how I'll use it. The early, you know, the early stuff, Murmur particularly, it's like Sigur Rós or This Mortal Coil, Elizabeth Frazier, people that...
Cocteau Twins
are creating languages or just singing nonsense without narrative. The narrative is within the emotion and the feeling of the voice. So I was doing that without even knowing what I was doing. I was just throwing words out that, you know, they didn't have to make sense. It didn't need that. It had my spirit and my soul and my energy and my charisma, whatever was there at the age of 22, all wrapped up in it. And that was enough. But it was around the time of Reckoning, the second album, and certainly by the third album, that I realized I couldn't do this forever. And the stuff that worked live for me wasn't particularly working on record. I needed to sharpen my storytelling, and I needed to start writing about something. At that same time, we were starting to travel the world, and we were becoming politicized by, again, the Reagan era, U.S. intervention in Central America, cruise missiles in Europe. We were representative of America wherever we went, and people were like, what the fuck are you doing? What are you allowing your government to do in your name? And we're like, excuse me, what? And so we became quite activist and politicized simply by traveling the world and seeing who we were and what we represented from a distance and through other people's eyes. The first lyric I wrote down was World Leader Pretend. And that was on Green, which was our sixth album, I think. And it was 9 years after the band started. So I didn't feel secure in my abilities as a lyricist. They didn't read well to me. You know what happened? I read the lyrics of a band that I really admired as a young man before I heard the song, and the lyrics were not very good. And it completely changed how I listened to the song. And it felt like it stole the magic of music and the magic of a human emotional voice away from me as a listener and as a fan. And so I think I'm putting this together as we speak, Debbie. I'm not kidding. I don't think about this stuff. I haven't heard Harbor Coat since I was 27 years old.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, I'm going to go listen to it after we're done talking. I'm interested to hear There's also a song called 9 to 9 on one of those records.
Yes.
I want to hear that too. I have no idea what it's about. But anyway, World Leader Pretend was the first song. And I lifted that basically from Leonard Cohen. It's using military terminology to describe very, very profound, deep and upsetting emotions. And the guy in the song is really eating himself alive and questioning his positions, questioning what he's doing to himself. But I thought that was a really, for me, a watermark moment. And so I allowed that lyric to be in the packaging of the album. That was 1989. It wasn't until Losing My Religion, which was 1991, that I allowed lip syncing in a video because it seemed fake to me. And it wasn't until after, I think, Bill Berry left the group in 1996 that I started including all the lyrics, just because I was like, okay, I've done that. I'm a really good lyricist now. When I'm good, I'm great. When I'm bad, I'm not mediocre, but I'm just bad. So that's okay. That's something to be proud of. And I included all the lyrics, for better or worse.
I want to talk to you about your current work. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you one last question about the older work, and that really has to do with a competition that I read that you had with Kurt Cobain to see who could write a song with the most yeah, yeah, yeahs.
So Kurt and I didn't have a literal competition with each other. I said to myself, I'm going to write a song with more yeahs in it than any Nirvana song ever written. And it was only after the song was written that I said, hey, Kurt, guess what I've done? And we had a laugh about it, I think. But that song was written in Seattle on a Walkman, walking around the block of the studio that we were working at. And, you know, Peter Buck had moved there, bought a house, started a family. And Kurt and Courtney bought the house next door. They literally shared a fence. It was an incredible moment for us as a band to find these people that were, you know, a little bit younger, but really our contemporaries, and moving into their ascendance with a similar attempt at grace and style that we had carried the whole time that we were doing what we were doing as a band, as R.E.M.
Well, in 2011, after countless awards, becoming one of the world's most successful and respected bands of all time, selling over 85 million albums.
More.
Okay.
It's always more. They always
more.
Though the American.
Oh, absolutely. 185 trillion.
I always say over 100 million. That's what I say.
Over 100 million. Yeah. Because when you see these things, you know, in on wherever, it's always like that moment in time. It's like, again, that time thing. It's like that moment.
I'm actually teasing. It's fine.
Oh,
we sold a lot of records. In 2011, we disbanded.
Without any acrimony, without anger. You still make and record music, but you do so many other things now. And you have a number of really beautiful books that I want to talk to you about. Mm. In 2018, along with Jonathan Berger, you published Michael Stipe, Volume 1, which is a collection of 35 photographs combining intimate moments with images of people like Kurt Cobain and Patti Smith, as well as photos that you've also collected of people like Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, Roy Cohn, and lots of others. And you've said that photography is your primary way of keeping a diary. And is it true you have over 50,000 photos in your collection?
There's a lot more. And if I turn the camera, we're speaking on Zoom for your podcasters. We can see each other, but I can turn just slightly. Do you see that mountain right there?
Yes.
That's about 50,000 negatives, and that's just in this studio. So I have three studios. This one, that's stuff that we've actually gone through and digitized. So those are secure in more than one medium now. But 50,000 doesn't begin to touch it. I use photography as a way of remembering where I was and who I was with and as a way of sparking my memory. Patti Smith writes everything down. I just don't write things down. I'm not very good at that. I never have been. I'm really good with taking a picture, and that will spark all kinds of memories, down to what was the meal, what were we eating, who was sat at the end of the table, who I maybe didn't talk to, but they were still present. They were still there in this incredible moment. I've had this extraordinary life surrounded by and meeting incredible, incredible people. And I've traveled the world. I've seen so many things. I've been in so many places that people dream of. And even talking about it, I'm in shock that that's my life. That's something that I am able to participate in. It's so thrilling and so exciting. You know, those pictures are a way for me to remember that and a way to kind of reflect back and have a diary, keep a journal. That's my journal.
I believe one of your first cameras was when your father had gotten you from Vietnam.
He bought it in Korea, and it was a Nikon FM2. It was stolen when I was 21 years old, along with a lot of weed and a jar full of pennies. But his insurance covered it, and he got another FM2, which I have to this day. Yeah, I used it when I was 14 years old. That was when he first loaned it to me, and I started taking pictures as a 14-year-old. It wasn't until I was 15 that I discovered music. So photography is really my first love in terms of mediums. In that first book that you mentioned, Volume 1, Jonathan Berger went through about, I think it was 35,000 or 50,000 of the images that I had on my computer, and he picked the 35 or 34 images that he thought represented me as a visual artist, in a way of presenting me not as a pop star with a hobby, but as someone who's been actually doing this all along to a larger audience. And I'm very grateful to him for the experience of putting that book together and actually having to take a step back and look at myself and my life through someone else's eyes. It was really exciting to see the choices that he made.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about your books is that they work on a whole slew of different levels. They're books of photography, so obviously they include photographs, which could work on their own, on a wall, somewhere. But then they're also talking to each other. They're communicating throughout. There is, in all of your books, a very specific linear narrative that changes from looking at one individual piece on a wall to communicating in multiple ways just by the virtue of the way that they're ordered and the way they show up and the size of the photo in the book. Right. How involved are you in the actual layout and the design of these books?
With music and with REM, we always thought that the first song on a record is really a really important way of introducing someone into a world of here's a universe that you may not have explored before, and here's our version of a different type of reality. So that first song is really important. The first notes, I employed that recently on the Velvet Underground cover version that I did of Sunday Morning for Todd Haynes's documentary about the Velvet Underground. I did it with Hal Wilner, my dear friend who died recently of COVID. And it was the last thing that Hal and I did together. But I wanted, knowing that it was going to be the first song on the album, I wanted to introduce the album in a way that would acknowledge that there's no way that anyone can ever copy or mimic the brilliance of the Velvet Underground's first album, but we can present variations on what those songs mean to different types of artists and musicians. And so I opened it with this long, keening held clarinet note that for me, I stole from Gershwin, from George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, but I presented that to the musician and said, this is what I want. I want it to hold for way too long. And then we'll bring the song in underneath it and allow that to be the introduction to the album. With the books, I'm doing the same thing. If you look at the beginning of each book, there is something that in the second book, it's you're literally, the first image is a window that's blackened, and it's inviting you into this unknown place. That book is quite, I think, accomplished. The first book as well, the Jonathan Berger book. The third book with Tilda Swinton on the cover is my pandemic book. And it is a little bit like me in third grade, not being able to read the clock quite right. It's a little stunted. It started as something that was quite tight in terms of the idea that I had for what the book was going to be. And it became something very different under the madness that became my COVID year of 2020. I went a little bit cuckoo, like I think a bunch of us did. And that is well represented in the book. But you need a little bit of a legend to get through it. Now the book does come with a QR code with me describing, audio describing.
It's a little podcasty. If you scan the QR codes, it's in a good way. If you scan, so for our listeners, if you scan the QR codes on various pages, they lead you to audio recordings of Michael talking about why he included the photographs and thinking about the narrative arc, the placement, which is super important. It's a real sort of multi-layered experience that I think is really interesting for the format.
It helps unravel the puzzle, and it shows my intention. My intention as an artist, is always to not have anyone feel left out. I want every single person that encounters anything that I do to feel smart when they walk away from it, to feel like they get it. They understand it on some level, whether it's visual, whether it's emotional, hopefully, whether it's a deeper understanding of themselves or a deeper understanding of something that's outside of what they might expect from a former pop star. You know, I want everyone to feel smarter when they come away from this, even if they just go, wow, that's a really pretty picture of Tilda Swinton. Isn't she a magnificent creature? Well, yes, she is. She also represents a ton of stuff that this book explores, and that's why she's on the cover. But anyway, I want everyone to step away feeling smarter. You know, that's one of my great heroes is Dolly Parton, and I think she's really good at describing her intention behind her work the same way. Everyone should feel lifted by and a part of what the piece is.
The thing that I like so much about the books, though, is that they, while they are really inclusive, I don't think that they would exclude anybody. They have different ways in. So in terms of your brand new book, that to me feels more like a play with different parts. You're going through it. There are very distinct emotions that you experience, whether you're looking at ceramics, whether you're looking at photographs. I think there's something kind of almost installation-y about it, whereas our interference times feels much more conceptual. It's much more abstract. It feels like you're diving into an experience. And a lot of the photographs feel like they're surrounding you, whereas in still life, portrait still life, you feel like you're going into something. If that makes any sense.
You completely nailed it. My mouth is hanging open. I can't believe that you just said what you said about the new book, because all the work that I'm doing right now is actually from, if you can picture two things, Uncle Vanya and the film Birdman. So a lot of it is coming from a proscenium stage using language of the theater and conceptually using all these ideas of being either an actor or someone on the side who's watching, who's a significant and important part of the production, but not in the public eye. So I'm using all these, and God knows there's tropes and there's layer upon layer upon layer of stuff around that. But that's what I'm using, not only in this book, but in all the work that I'm doing right now in the studio. And you just nailed it on the head with no provocation at all. I'm super,
oh,
that's super exciting to me, Debbie.
Thank you. I'm really loving the work. And I think especially Portrait Still Life feels like it needs to be explored materially, if that makes sense, like sort of in a location.
Thank you. It will be in Milan, fall of 22, at the ICA Milano, the Institute of Contemporary Art. They're doing my first giant exhibition of my work, and it's going to focus on these three books. The vases that are in the book, which are real vases that were photographed, made by the ceramicist Caroline Wallner. And the books, which are real books, but in that language that we were just speaking of the theater,
right.
They're photographed to look like a digital image of a book rather than a real book itself. And so what you're looking at is a real image that looks like a fake image. And if you look closely, you just get a little shadow here and there, and you realize that the background of the books, the edges of the books are not exactly the same from one picture to the other. They are real. And so they're going to be a part of it. Some of them represent people who are no longer with us on this plane, the ghost images, the ghost books, and some of them represent people that are with us. But it's all people who, for one reason or another, last year, in trying to put together a book of portraits of people who I found to be immensely courageous and vulnerable at the same time, and using that vulnerability to allow a humanity into their work or into the way that they presented themselves as public figures, or as people in my lives, or as people that are not public figures but were pushed into the public sphere through some one incident or another, Black Lives Matter having a huge amount to do with it. All those people found their way into my consciousness in pandemic 2020 and therefore into this book. It's a little bit of my shout out song. My best friend called it that, the James Brown shout out song to everyone in 2020 who caught my eye and touched my heart.
Well, it's a beautiful book. I think you also rekindled an interest that you had in fonts and designed some of the fonts yourself for the book.
Speaking of design, I mean, there are two things that the one thing on earth that horrifies me more than anything is injustice. When I see injustice, I see red. I just become furious. The second thing after injustice that bugs me, makes me crazy, is bad design. So.
Oh, yeah. Let's just talk quickly. I just want to ask you about the fonts, because you did design the fonts, right?
Well, I pulled them from the 1970s, or is that's the era that I was a teenager, and all these things, right. Like all these important things, like discovering my own sexuality, deciding to embrace that within myself, discovering punk rock, and the idea of being a pop star and being a public figure. Embracing that, all the fonts that were happening in the 70s, that's my sweet spot. And so had I not found music or photography, I think I would have been a very failed graphic artist or graphic designer. And so I explored that in this book. Under lockdown, I pulled fonts that reminded me of the 1970s and spoke to me as such. And then I used them in books that, again, look like either computer-generated images of books or they look like really trashy collages, which was, of course, intentional. But I cut and pasted my version of these heroic and vulnerable people into books and then re-photographed them for my book.
Michael, it has been an absolute honor talking with you today. Thank you so much for joining me on Design Matters.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Michael Stipe's latest book is an untitled book of portraits and still lives. You can find out more about him and see a lot more of his work on michaelstipe.com. This is the 17th year we've been podcasting Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters is produced for the TED Audio Collective by Curtis Fox Productions. In non-pandemic times, the show is recorded at the School of Visual Arts Masters and Branding Program in New York City, the first and longest-running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Emily Weiland.